bypass it away. I want to avoid
it. Here's side three.
Okay, we were talking about the difficulties with it works. Well, the work that these folks were doing was great. In many respects, it was very great. They had been able to take a whole lot of voices, a whole lot of information, and put it into a single style, put it into a sequence that was comprehensible, put it into a readable level of language that kind of valid, where someone who provided input might have been a PhD and talked above my head and averaged that into where anybody could read it. However, there were some concerns about the work that they were doing and how they were working. We eventually began to feel that they weren't as receptive to our need to have them modify what they've written to satisfy our idiosyncrasies. I say our, I'm talking about the literature chairperson and the committee, included Sydney R. And Sally, who are trustees, and the two people from the conference, the literature chairperson and vice chairperson, and one of the office directors. And that was the committee that worked with this writing. And they were beginning to doubt whether these people would be willing to make adjustments in what they were writing to accommodate their concerns, the committee's concerns. And that eventually reached a deadlock. They, in July of that year, finally concluded that, you know, listen, we're professionals, we know how to structure sentences, and we know this and that, and you're going to work on this after we're done anyway, so why bother us? And they, sensing our unhappiness, offered to terminate the contract at about a third of what the contract was for. And I think in August, September of that year, they officially sent a letter saying we've offered to terminate the contract this amount, and I went to the board of directors. After I talked to the committee had said, yeah, we think you'll accept it. And I wrote a letter accepting the determination. Had they finished the work, I'm not sure it would have made a difference.
Was it a substantial financial loss?
It wasn't a loss.
No loss? Okay.
It wasn't a loss. The committee then took that material and worked on themselves, which is what they were going to do.
Yeah.
And the committee worked on that, making substantial changes in it. This is the literature review committee. Made substantial changes in it, and that was later published. And a lot of people liked it. Some didn't.
First publication of It Works on What?
Yeah, it was a white
review, 1987, I think.
Now, what occurred was a procedural nightmare that began to envelop the whole thing. The original publication of work on the steps and conditions was what came out of the San Diego meeting. The literature chairperson at the time felt obligated to publish that work, even if it was crap. And the committee thought it was awful. But the conference had been told they were going to do it February that year, so it was done. But like I said, if you could find a copy, then you'd find it's hardly worth considering publishing. That was the review form. So the way the committee's structured procedure was, the next time you publish it, it's approval form. And there was a debate about whether they should call this next one approval form or review form. And the committee elected to call it approval form.
The white one.
The white
one. Yeah.
You're going back.
Okay,
well, that's fun. I'll be down in a little bit.
I know. A little bit later.
Okay.
You guys down
front? Yep. I'm telling him the story of Albert Schweitzer.
Oh, okay. What's
that to do, Vinay? So the literature committee decided, or review committee of literature decided to publish this as an approval form. And because it was so substantially different from the review and input, it caused a lot of controversy. And it caused a lot of controversy because the fellowship did not fully understand how the work done by a writer had been used. Some people presumed that what they had written was what they'd see, which wasn't the case. The committee had substantially altered the work that they had received from these books. A lot of people assumed that what they were reading in the white version of this was what the people who had been contracted had actually written word for word. And it wasn't the case. The review committee had edited it, altered it, revised it to meet what they believed was what should be in the book. But there was a popular misconception put out by people who were opposed to having anyone paid to do work in the book that said, this is tainted and we can't use it. So that position was so strongly advanced that the fellowship in general said, well, if there's smoke, there must be fire, so maybe there's something to this, and we'll just put it aside and not use it.
Voted it down.
And they voted it down. Yeah. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I think that the emotionalism was dishonestly put forward in many respects, and that the motivations behind some of the people who were involved wasn't as much what was in the language or the procedure, but they weren't in charge of what was going on and wanted it done differently. So they went back to the drawing boards, but the way that the motions were handled when that came back to the conference, which would have been 1985, there was no action to change the language of the committee guidelines that allowed them to use work prepared by others who paid to do it in a literature. That provision of the guidelines was retained. The literature review committee had decided that they wanted to try again. So they came back to us and said, well, what we'll do is we will take all this material we have on steps and we will workshop it. And we will add more and get more and rewrite. We'll start from scratch on steps. But on the conditions, let's take what we've already got and hire someone to help us with that. So in the summer of 1985, a separate contract was generated with someone that the committee had found, saying, organize this material on the traditions, and that was done. I think in the long run that was helpful, but again, the material was never used or intended to be used directly from the person who wrote it. It went back to the Literature Review Committee, and they butchered it up, however they did. The fire over the idea of using a paid person just kept growing. And it became eventually aware to some people that the person involved was not an animator. And that became more or less a sacrilegious decision in the minds of a lot of people. That you couldn't allow a non-member to have anything to do with the generation of literature for the fellowship.
Right.
So that doomed, essentially, the material that came out of the second contract before it ever had a fair chance of any detail work by the literature. Here, puppy. Oh, yes. Come on. Come around this way. So that was the story of all that. I've not read what came as a result of all the years of work on the book on Steps and Traditions. So I'm no judge to determine whether or not any of what was done in those early years is still included in there. No idea. So the question of was the money wasted, you can take any side of that you want. Whether or not we ever got any use out of that material, I think a lot of people did. We had produced, I think, 5,000 copies of the steps in the white publication. We sold all of them. They were used by people all over the world.
That's the reason.
So, it's a matter of whether you like that publication or not, and whether or not it was wasted. You know, as it turned out, you take the money that we charged for that, which is like about $5 times the 5,000 copies, and that's $25,000 income. That was a little less by about $12,000 than what it cost to do it. So the loss, the fellowship, if you want to say that it was lost, wasn't far terribly much, though. So that gets us done with...
Hi there.
Gets us done with literature stuff. There's a question here about the guide to service generated out of the select committee was printed. Were very many of these actually sold? There were a number of editions of that. I think about 5. And along the way, I think there's 1 or 2 editions of that draft that didn't sell very well. We tended to make 2,000 or 3,000 copies of these things, and over only service junkies would really buy them. Committees didn't want to get involved in that because it was more hassle than productive, and they're more concerned with recovery than this structural stuff that they don't otherwise want to get involved in. I don't know how many were actually sold.
I don't know if you want to. I'm going to ask what I read in the New Awakenings about the price of the business test and giving the office on its feet.
Mm-hmm.
Is that. Do you think that the book should still be price going up or should be going down?
Well, there was. People have told me from time to time that the office or somebody, the conference or the literature committee had said that they would have the price artificially high for a period of time and then reduce it. I've never found anything from the literature committee or the office that ever said that. I know people have made that statement to me for 10 years or more. I've never seen anything of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
During the time that I was with the World Service Office, the question of that occurring never arose seriously. There were discussions from time to time about the pricing of the business test, but there was never any substantial percentage of the board of directors who felt that that should occur. It's a matter of something that is both easy to understand and hard to accept. Okay? It's easy to understand. We have a fellowship in India. Average wage for the membership in India is probably what amounts to an American maybe $60 a year, maybe $7. They don't read English very well. Very few of them read English.
Mm-hmm.
The only way that they're going to get literature is if someone else translates it for them and provides it for them.
Mm-hmm.
The same with most of the other languages. French could have done their own. Germans would have done their own. Spanish, over a long period of time, could have done their own. Portuguese, maybe. Most of the others, not. We had a number of discussions on the issue of literature in non-English languages with that AA company. And their position was that they refused to get involved in translations. They said to people in different languages, you want to take our book, translate it, you do that, but let us know, send us copies, and protect the rights. Well, they made a couple of mistakes in doing that. What they learned from that mistake was that in some places, people translated it differently than what their English language version would convey.
Yeah.
For instance, in German, when they just let the Germans do whatever they want to do, the translation comes across in German as though your recovery isn't really a higher power thing. It's me. I can do this. Not a higher power gift and guidance and
rational recovery.
So what they now have learned over the years is that was a mistake, because the translations that they went through were done by people young in recovery, and there was never any assurance of the level of understanding spiritually of the people involved, and there was never any certainty of the level of understanding of the languages involved by the people in the translations. We fell into that trap once. We had a member from Canada translate some stuff into French, and we printed it the way he wrote it for us from the translation. The people back home in Canada refused to use it because it was so poorly written. They said, "This, what idiot wrote this?" And what we learned was the guy's grasp of both languages was inadequate to the need. So from that, it became real clear that if NA was going to maintain consistency in its spiritual message from the English to other languages, that was going to have to be done under the management of rural services rather than as
therefore financial burden.
Yeah. The other part of that that makes it really understandable is if you understand the world's economy and the world's populations, there are only probably a half dozen, maybe 18, countries in the world where the standard of living is adequate to sustain this kind of duty of translation, production, printing, and distribution from local economies. And where this is easily understood is that that is the same problem that religious organizations have faced through the centuries. And that's why Christian missionaries are sent all over the world from the developed countries, the rich countries, where they can afford to do this. America being the bastion of all of this kind of work. And the same is true with relief efforts. When you want to stop starvation in Somalia, you get America to do it. Yeah. You can see where this is leading. Maybe it became really then a conflict of, do we put this burden financially on the member of NA or do we find another way to do it? Well, there really is no way. We can't go out and borrow money from the government or ask for donations from the world to translate this. It became the understanding of the people in rural services that rural services had the duty of protecting the spiritual integrity of the translations. And then, realistically, in order to get the material in the hands of other people, we had to print it for them. You can't do that unless you charge enough money from American members to sustain those costs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the basic issue. Now, I used to make that explanation at the World Service Conference on the two occasions when a motion came up to reduce the price to basic tax. I said, you have a choice. I'm not a member. I'm not likely to go out and be susceptible to using drugs. But there are thousands of people in other countries where we have no language and material in that language, and no meetings, and those people are just going to continue to die if you reduce the price of the book, because we're not going to have the money to provide these services. And it really was never my decision, but I'm the one who got up and made that argument, and I would still make that argument today. As tough as it is for an average NA member, when he comes back in the fellowship, who's lost every bit of money he's got, who's unemployed, he's in treatment, and doesn't think straight, for him to pay $8.80 or $9 for basic text ain't easy. I've never said it was easy.
Right.
But the chances are pretty good that within a year or two that member's going to have a job, and that he's going to be in a better position to pay $8 per book. Or $9, $10. And that's the issue, as it's always been argued that World Services over the price of basic fare. Regardless of what may have been said by somebody back in 82 when this was all going on.
I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that. You know, when I read that, it was to prove that price be set in order to lay high and then be lowered. I'm going, taking that as gospel, and there's never been a rebuttal.
Well,
I've heard it.
In
there's no real documentation
yet
that you've seen.
In two of the times that it came along the road to change the price back down.
I remember that.
I did address that issue. As far as I know, I've never seen anything about it.
There was a motion by our region sent to the conference this year in Atlanta to put it before the conference that the soft cover basic tax be available for $5. And our RSR was talked to on the sidelines about the motion, and he decided that he wouldn't present the motion. So the money issue has not gone away.
And it probably won't. See, the approach that I've always had with that is that these are issues that the Board of Trustees was responsible for, not the office. Because these are spiritual matters. They're not business matters. The office always got put in the position of having to do it because the trustees never had the balls to do their job as a spiritual guide and fellowship.
Just like the HIV issue. Look how many years it took them to respond to that crowd.
Have they? I didn't know they did.
They came out on a position letter or whatever they call it. It was drafted and basically saying it's outside issue. And I remember calling the office in 1987.
See, if is my only criticism I'll level against anybody in fellowship, is that the trustees as a group have consistently, for the 14 years I have fairly close observation, refused to take the leadership role in addressing the issues of the fellowship at the fellowship level. If Missouri wants to talk about reducing the price of basic tax, it should be the task of the trustees to visit enough places in Missouri to address the issues so the issue can be discussed openly wherever it needs to be discussed. Now, if the fellowship in Missouri wants to make that decision that the cost should change and these other consequences result from it, then I can understand that being put forward again. But
you see,
the fellowship has never been given the opportunity to look at all the sides of the issue. They see this from the perspective of our guy is coming out of treatment, and ain't got any money, why in the hell should we pay all this goddamn money for it? In the book.
And then you got the addict in Missouri, myself, who tries to stay informed, finds it very hard. And I see the budget of the trustees, majority of the money going for travel, thinking that can be eliminated. And the savings there can be reducing the price of basic tax. You know, so
I would say that that's a false economy if the trustees are doing the job.
Mm-hmm.
Someone has got to take leadership in spiritual matters, and nobody does.
Mm-hmm. Because do you think it would be because of like's been construed about the basic tax not getting written? That everybody was afraid to be the person who's saying, well, I'm willing.
I don't know what the implications. I don't know what reasons they have for not doing assertive work in the fellowship on spiritual issues.
Would it be in their bylaws or?
There's nothing in the bylaws or the guidelines to prevent them from doing those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
Those are about all the questions that I thought on here that were of value or relevant for me to talk about. There are a number of questions here of things that have taken place since I've left or about the time of my leaving, and I don't see that there would be any value in my my opinion of those things. Because it would be a thing rather than a fact that I could tell you about. There were a few questions here that were worded in a way that I wouldn't have responded simply because it's a leading question that leads us into a meaningless discussion. And I've always taken the approach that let's talk about the things that have value and leave the meaningless things alone. So that's about it. I don't remember if I asked you or answered this question about what would you like to have the fellowship know, one important thing, that what would that be? Did I don't talk about that? I have probably a long shopping list of things that I would like to leave the fellowship in terms of, gee, you ought to be doing this. But it's difficult to do that from the position I have. I believe in fellowship. My task as an employee always was to give advice to the boards that I reported to, which was actually all three of them. And I gave that advice often, sometimes strongly, but I always left it with them to make the decision. They were the members, not me. And in the ultimate scheme of things, they're the ones who are responsible, so they're the ones who have to make the decision. But the only thing I would say that would generally represent the thrust of this question, in part, addresses what was my original, still is my reluctance to sit for this interview. There's too much energy devoted to divisiveness rather than constructive building of the fellowship and meeting the needs of others. There's too much suspicion by those who are not in authority or responsible positions of those who are in authority and in responsible positions. And that distrust carries with it so much energy and so much time that's lost from carrying the message to other areas. So if I were to leave anything as thoughts about fellowship, it needs from the highest level to the lowest level to get out of this adversarial relationship over who's in charge and what's being done, and work together to find solutions to the problems that really do exist, and get about carrying the message of recovery to other people. The only substantial ways that I've seen in the fellowship in my association reside specifically in that area. About the time I was leaving the office in 1990, there was a growing problem with a fellow named Dave in the East.
And great for Dave.
He was, we were told, printing his edition of the basic text. And the discussions that were ensuing about that particular time was how to deal with this. And my advice to the people at the time that I reported to was that you had a responsibility to deal with it legally. But if you deal with it primarily legally, you're going to spend an awful lot of money and you're not going to really accomplish a whole lot. You may enforce the copyright responsibility that you have, but you do have the duty to do. But unless you go into the groups and the areas where this occurs and speak with authority about spiritual principles involved in this matter, you're not going to win, and it's never going to go away. And I tried my best in the year 1990 to convince and cajole the trustees to explain to them it's your job. This is not a World Service Office man. It is your job to go and talk about spiritual principles involved with bootleg printing, printing material that is different than as the conference has approved it, and if you can't find enough spiritual foundation to stop it, then you should continue. You should allow it.
Mm-hmm. Goodness, you guys are still here.
Yep. Can I fix your sandwich?
Well, as a matter of fact, we haven't eaten and we're about done. In the midst of my last sentence this year. So, yes. I was explaining what... There was a question here. If you would like to have the fellowship know one important thing, what would that be? And I was just beginning to explain that that issue is that they need to stop this incessant...
We're on side number four.
Okay. As we were concluding my remarks, I was reminded of the pulpit that I've been standing on from time to time about a different issue that I could leave some parting words about. Of the nearly 200 people who were involved in the World Service Conference in 1983, about 80% of those people are still clean. About 20% of them are still in NA. The rest are someplace else. And if you went through every year of all the leadership positions in the region of the Show Me region and all the other places, you'd find a very similar statistic that as people reach 5 years and 6 years, more than half of them leave the fellowship and go to some other thing. And that has always been an enormous detriment to the strength of the fellowship.
What's the solution?
Well, the solution is actually, in my opinion, very simple. We spend a lot of time dealing with H&I, we spend a lot of time with PI, and a lot of time with leadership. I mean, with literature. You need a committee and a process involved with retention. Other organizations understand that they lose their membership after a period of time, and a whole handbook needs to be developed from people who have dealt with this and seen it and understand it, so that they can develop guidance on how you as a member may confront with the guy who you see at a meeting who comes once a year to get his medallion, and you see him maybe once or twice in between, but you always see him at the AA thing that you hear about. What do you do to explain to that person? What do you do to entice, recruit that person to stay in NA? Well, there are some very definite opinions and very different answers to that. And I hear them all the time. The one I hear most is, we have a responsibility to be there for the newcomer. But that doesn't cut it after 5 or 6 or 7 years with a person who feels they're tired of giving, it doesn't get them. Well, it may be that they still need to give in order to get, but they kind of block that out. But no one confronts them in a way that gets to them. Well, there's a whole list of things you can say to people to eventually crush the right bucket. We just don't have those as a ready reservoir for you to use against those people who will head for the hills. So, NA needs to get involved seriously with the members beyond 5 years so that you don't have this pyramid thing come so soon and with so few years. There is a small circle of people in NA, small pyramids of people in NA who've been around 10 years or more, when there should be 5 or 6 times that. As long as they continue to do that, NA will have a certain form of immaturity that helps push these people away. They find the maturity and the calmness in other places, and that's where they go. So as long as they're going, they're not retaining that and bringing that level of calmness and maturity here. It's a very such a thing. in this journey that I'm on now, it's about the only thing that I'm actively promoting to my friends and acquaintances across the country.
Good. Noble cause. I've seen it. And I talked about it in Ireland with members in Ireland. Brought this up sitting around the old stove. You know, it's everywhere. It's not just here.
I would say it's more evident overseas.
Yeah.
In England, Ireland. Germany, not so much. I think the Germans have a better retention of it. There's an adversarial relationship between AA and NA in Germany, where most NAs don't feel at all comfortable in AA. And it actually has to do with that language issue we talked about. Because the people that come into NA in Germany are imbued with the idea that this is a God-centered program, a God-powered program, not me as a person. So they go to AA and they talk about God doing this and God that. And the AA folks in Germany don't want to hear the prayer.
Yeah.
So there's not that same transition.
I've got a question that I've posed to the Fred to publish, and that's a request from everybody about how they think the new items should be made available from the office. Like the literature rack and key tags and that kind of stuff. Like our office, regional service office, will put together a newcomer packet. Now they're selling an outside enterprise's jewelry and that kind of stuff from our office. I'm sure you were around. Were key tags around before you got there?
Oh, yeah.
How was that? Somebody's home group decided that they needed key tags?
There's two different issues that are involved with what you're talking about. One is a philosophical issue. That's kind of the one you're seeing. Philosophically, should we be doing this? Should we not be doing this?
Right.
The other issue you haven't talked about, you wouldn't necessarily address, that's the legal issue. And that's best illustrated by a problem that arose some time back in the scheme of the problems we were dealing with at the World Service Office when I was there, in the mid-80s. One of the issues we put off dealing with until we had solved some of the other problems was the legal implications of fellowship. We had a fair number of people who made jewelry or clocks or t-shirts or bumper stickers or all kinds of things that had the NA logo on them.
Days Clean and Crazy.
Days was the first.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that was second. Sea-Doo came first. We won't talk about Sea-Doo. Those of us who have some concern about the legal responsibilities of any organization, in this case, which is the legal responsibilities and legal aspects of NA, we're concerned by these people doing these things.
Mm-hmm.
And we had at the time, and I think they still use, an exceptionally bright attorney who handles nothing but trademark and copyright matters. It was a provident fine in terms of consultant relationships. And at issue really is what legal rights exist over the management control of trademarks. There is generally, I would tell you, a provision in the law from custom, not from legislation. If you don't use it, you lose it.
Mm-hmm.
And we found this to be the case when we started going around to all the vendors. We went to Dave at Dave's Been Crazy and said, you've got to recognize we own these rights and someday we're going to have you sign an agreement that acknowledges that. His answer was, yeah, okay. You give me a paper to sign, and I'll sign. Just as long as you let me keep doing it. That's a different question, but we needed the acknowledgement first. And we went to Bill H. in Florida, and I even talked to Camille here. And everybody was always verbally willing to say, well, when the time comes, give me a thing to sign, I'll sign it, because I'm a member, and I don't own this, and I'll acknowledge the ownership. But if you are going to cut me out of the business, some of them said like Bill, give me a couple of years to do it. Don't just cut me off overnight, because I've got lots of money invested here, and if I'm going to have to find another job or do something else, don't give me all the stuff I can't sell.
Mm-hmm.
So we essentially, in my discussion with these folks, told them, when the time comes, we will be polite to you as long as you play ball and acknowledge any ownership. Well, there was a fellow up in Northern California who was a AA person, and he wasn't that compliant. So we had some discussions with him and said, we want you to recognize our ownership of these. And he said, no, not the case. You don't own it. You can't stop me. Tough. We had to sue him. And we went to court. I remember going to a pretrial conference with a federal judge in San Jose in May of 1990. And we had a negotiating session with their attorneys and our attorneys before we went before the judge. We couldn't reach agreement. Went before the judge. The judge essentially said that in the federal district court, a prior decision had been reached that had precedence in this matter. It was a case of a guy in Northern California who made floor mats for Ford cars at the old-style Ford engine. And he'd been making these things for years from the 40s. And in the 60s, Ford Motor Company decided that, whoops, we think this guy is getting too rich, or we want to do this ourselves, and they sued him. And the federal district court in the ninth district ruled that because this was an interstate commerce matter and Ford had elected not to do it, that this man had a right to use whatever he wanted to use to use that same logo in a field of business that Ford wasn't doing. Ford wasn't making comparable matter. If he decided to make cars and put Ford name on it, the district court undoubtedly would have said, do that. But Ford Company wasn't making these formats. Okay, what this told us is the ninth district court that encompassed the World Service Office, if the World Service Office didn't engage in the commerce involving the logo, the emblem, etc., in these different things, any place we didn't, somebody else could, and with immunity.
As in jewelry.
As in jewelry. So what that really said is that in order for NA to protect the ownership of the logo, emblem, rights, the trademark, copyright, etc., we had to be in the jewelry. And the right thing for us to do, essentially, was to do these things through license agreements. You want to do it, you sign a paper acknowledging the rights. Whether you pay us a royalty or not is negotiable as far as however the conference wants to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the direction we were going in at the time all that was transpired since then.
Well, I guess what I was kind of getting at was the directly responsible to those that serve in the ninth tradition, the creative committee, our regional service office. And the trend that I see is they do things and then they come and tell us what they did.
I have no way of giving that answer. I don't know the people involved.
Well, I guess...
do I believe the people should be responsible for those they serve within the matter of how the service structure is outlined? Absolutely.
So, the way I see it is things happen, the cart before the horse often. And that, and instead of the other way around, so we would like to see this happen. And then propose it to those they serve, and then...
So now you'll have to keep working, I'm sure.
Well, I wish you would answer that one question there about
is this a dying request answer?
Have you been asked for your suggestions about the way the proposed changes of service that talked to you at all?
Since I left? The board of directors and the World Service Conference and the board of trustees have not communicated to me verbally or in writing any requests at all.
This is what is your dream for the program that you spent so much time with?
The dream's simple.
Flourish?
Well, the dream would be that the opportunity to come to an NA meeting and be a member of NA would be available to anybody who uses drugs. And they would have that knowledge essentially in advance of their ever using. And that they would have the confidence of knowing that in the course of their own events, they understand that they're an addict and they need to find recovery, that they will find it and can find it. I'm sure that's basically what everyone else would dream for.
Wherever they're at.
I could say I would dream we would never have drugs, but that's not realistic. My dream is more realistic.
Yeah. Are you a realist?
If anything, more realist, yeah.
Are you a purist then?
I'm not sure that you're on an equitable basis. One isn't necessarily related to the other.
From your remark earlier about getting and staying in NA, I think you're a purist. That's the way I like to refer to myself. Bob, thank you for your time, energy.
Well, like I said, I was reticent to have this done or do it because I haven't, in the three copies of this thing I've seen at all, been pleased because of what I think is it facilitates the conflict, the controversy in the fellowship, because it takes no responsibility for its content. And that's kind of like saying that it's okay to take it through a gas bomb into a crowded room because I'm not in the room, so but anybody who's in the room will going to see this explosion, so they know it's going to take place, and they have to fend for themselves. But that really isn't the way the world is supposed to work when it comes to responsibility. If I'm going to make this bomb and I'm going to throw it in there, I'm going to be responsible for what occurs. And this publication doesn't seem to be doing that about what it allows to be printed in the pages.
And it should be looked at.
Absolutely. To print allegations of things that are untrue, particularly in a spiritual fellowship, is just absolutely unconscionable. You just really wrong. Like I told you, I don't know what article it was. I saw one paragraph, this one article, and I read through it. And every sentence of this 8 or 9 sentence paragraph was untrue or incorrect.
It wasn't about the World Convention, was it?
I don't remember.
I've written one article for the magazine about the World Convention. And I tied it in with extortion. Outrageous. $35 to register.
Yeah.
You didn't have to report to that board too, did you?
Oh, yeah.
You did. Corporations. The NA Way.
We only had two at the time.
The NA Way one?
No.
Oh, it was part of the office?
Yeah, it was part of, yeah, part of the office. So it was the Convention Corporation and the Office Corporation. I have no idea what it is. But,
have you been interviewed for the NA Way or anything like that? Is this your first interview?
Yeah, this is my first and last interview. There will never be another. I will not be on 60 Minutes, 2020.
Oprah?
Oprah, no.
Have you been approached?
No need. Nothing.
Well, you've done a lot for the growth of Narcotics Anonymous.
Anybody who had some business experience could have done the very same thing that they probably did. There wasn't anything that I did that was unique or so different from what could have been done or would have been done by others. I've always felt gratified that I had the opportunity to do it, but I never felt that there was anything I did that was something that somebody else couldn't do.
Monumental.
I don't need to be the Bill Wilson. Something to me.
I thought it was Mr. Bill. Or Dr. Bill.
Dr. Bill.
How was your workshop, Bob?
Pretty good. Not bad.
Thanks again, Bob.